Well, this is a first. It's December 12th, and we wanted to meet this morning, and I had a message I was very enthused about giving this morning, but we basically got blizzarded out and instead ended up doing a lot of shoveling, which was fine, but I wanted you to have this message. So what we were doing is putting this on a podcast. We put all our messages on podcasts, but this one won't have an audience, which is kind of awkward, but I'm going to give you this message anyway because I am really excited about us getting this as a church family, holding these truths together and practicing them together. The message is called Because He Came, We Can Know Him. It's the first of our series of Because He Came messages. Tim will have another one next week, and Adam will have one on the 26th. But this morning is Because He Came, We Can Know Him. And this is the way I was intending to do it. This morning, I'm going to take you to the movies. Now, I'm not a movie buff, and I'm not very adept at finding movie clips on the internet, so what I was going to do this morning was to ask you to create these scenes in your own mind as I describe them to you. First of all, about a month ago, our daughter Grace and I went to see the movie Secretariat. Secretariat was a racehorse that won the Triple Crown back in 1973. That doesn't happen very often. And the movie is about the personal triumph of the horse's owner in bringing this seemingly unknown horse to that level of success. In fact, the record still stands today. What, 37 years later, at 2 minutes and 24 seconds for the Belmont Stakes, the last of the three races. Now, I want you to picture the scene in the movie just at the start of the Belmont Stakes. Here we are, you know, ready to compete for a possible Triple Crown. Now picture all the horses in their stalls, the gates just about ready to spring open, and boom, they open up, and the horses spring out. What would happen if at that point the music and the roar of the crowd stopped? I mean, there'd probably still be a little excitement over watching the horses compete, but if the background music was gone and the roar of the crowds was gone, all the emotional parts of the event that make you feel like you were involved would be missing. I'm building up to a major point this morning, so let me give you another example. Many of you would know the Andy Griffith Show. That's way back in the day. But I'd venture to guess that any of you who have heard of the Andy Griffith Show, the first thing that comes to mind would be the theme song. There's a scene in that thing that's, I think it's at the beginning and the end of each show, that show Andy and Opie just strolling down a dirt road to a pond to go fishing and to skip some rocks. Well, there's a guy whistling a song, and you know what it is, da-da-da-da-da, you know? It fits perfectly for Mayberry. It gives you the immediate sense that you're about to visit Mayberry, South Carolina, complete with, you know, town gossip and friends for life, all that kind of stuff. What would it be like if you took the music away from that opening and closing clip of Andy and Opie strolling down the road? Would you even watch it? I mean, it's kind of dull just to watch two guys walking down a road. You probably wouldn't watch it. One more, please. I just want everybody to get the point here. And by giving you three of them, hopefully I've hit at least one movie that you're familiar with. Ever seen the movie Princess Bride? There's a scene in it where Vicini has abducted the girl Buttercup in his sailboat. Now, there's concern on his boat because their secret plan might be found out if anyone were to see what they were doing, and there seems to be another boat getting closer and closer every minute, which is inconceivable. But Vicini says he's not alarmed by that because he knows that he's taking the princess up the cliffs of insanity. What would that section of the movie be like without the suspense of the music? I mean, you might as well take away the words of the movie also and just make it a silent movie. The music paints in all the color of emotion that allows you to participate in that thrill. Okay, So you know what I'm talking about here. Now turn to Colossians 1, verse 9. Paul says that he and Timothy, since the day they heard of the conversions of many in Colossae, that's how you say that word, that city, since he heard of their, since they heard of the conversion to faith in Jesus Christ, they had not ceased to pray for them. And what they prayed is that the Colossians would be filled with the knowledge of his will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding. By the way, I'll say this at this point. We have a Word document that is also on the website, what would be called Because He Came Worksheet. And you can open up that worksheet and follow along. There'll be blanks to fill in. I won't tell you what the blanks are because I don't have that in front of me, but they'll be word for word. You can fill them in and kind of know what to anticipate. So my first major point is that spiritual wisdom and understanding is the music of the movie of your life. It's what gives your life motivation and freedom. Without it, you have only information. It is spiritual wisdom which makes the will of God experiential. We'll be developing this thought as we go along. Because he came, we can know him, but he is only known to us through spiritual wisdom and understanding. Jesus is probably not going to show up in bodily form at your supper table tonight. You probably won't find him physically in your next college lecture. You can't know him that way. He can only be known to you and me in experience through spiritual wisdom and understanding. This is important to know. It means that you must gain something greater than information about God. Remember your salvation? Remember when the light came on? You probably knew a lot of information about God in the Bible before that event, but at that event, you were given spiritual wisdom and insight to know your lost and needy condition, and it made reaching out to Jesus, which some would say is ridiculous, seem like the only right thing for you to do. I remember that moment well for me personally. You could have offered me the world, and I would have, without a moment's hesitation, taken forgiveness instead. It was so clear to me what the better choice was. I had a moment of spiritual wisdom. Paul prayed a similar thing for the whole Ephesian church. He prayed that the eyes of their hearts would be enlightened so that they might know what is the hope of his calling. I think Tim's going to talk about Because He Came, We Have Hope next week. Paul prayed this for the Ephesian church. And what are the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the saints? And what is the surpassing greatness of his power towards those who believe? The eyes of the heart that he's talking about here are able to see spiritual wisdom and understand. Our heart eyes can see spiritual wisdom and understanding. This is how we come to know him in an experiential way. To the Corinthians, Paul said, and this is in 1 Corinthians 2:14, that a natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them because they are spiritually appraised. Again, the only way for you to know him is through spiritual wisdom and understanding. I pray that we become a spiritual people, a people guided by the Spirit. Remember, Romans 8 says, as many as are the sons of God, they're led by the Spirit of God. I pray that we become a dwelling of God in the Spirit, a lampstand here in Decorah with true light to shine into our community. A related subject to this is your own personal Bible study. Sometime we may do a seminar on having a daily time of reading the Scriptures. Some of us call it a quiet time because we generally try to do it in the quiet. Some of us use a one-year Bible to keep us moving through the Scriptures, completing it in a year. But the point is that you won't come up with spiritual wisdom and understanding apart from a generous intake of the Word of God. But we'll develop that another time. Let me define spiritual wisdom for you. The words are kind of mysterious, so I want to give you a definition. Spiritual wisdom is simply the faith that makes the unseen will of God seem appropriate, right, and doable. Spiritual wisdom is the faith that makes the unseen will of God seem appropriate, right, and doable. Spiritual wisdom and understanding supplies the motivation for obeying Him. It's what makes the commands of God not a burden. Without it, you only have information. Without spiritual wisdom, all the commands of God will tend to embitter you as they pile on. With spiritual wisdom, the will of God will tend to embolden you. It was spiritual wisdom, as Tim pointed out in Acts 7, which made the will of God for the moment known to Stephen as he was empowered to play his role. This is just so incredibly important. This is one of the chief things that separates you if you have put your faith in Jesus Christ from those who haven't, is this issue of spiritual wisdom and insight. The verse we read earlier said that the things of the Spirit are foolishness to the natural mind. But when God opens your heart eyes, they aren't foolishness to you. They make good sense. They seem to be only appropriate. The New Testament is filled with reasonings like, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. Doesn't that make sense? It does to us. Jesus is quoted in John as saying, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another even as I have loved you, that you love one another." How did Jesus love us? When we were worthy? Nope. Then that becomes our willingness to display love to our brother and sister. So spiritual wisdom is the faith that makes the unseen will of God seem appropriate, right, and doable. Now, with the balance of our time, I'd like to focus in on one aspect of spiritual insight. It is the area of humility. This is perhaps the character quality that is the most overlooked or underrated or maybe the least practiced by us Christians. Everybody seems to know that God is powerful, and many would say that He's loving. But just exactly what it means that He is humble is much less known. It is much less focused on. And I just say this is to our great disadvantage in knowing Him. Let me explain. You cannot know someone other than how they really are. For example, if somebody lied about me and told you that I was a drill sergeant kind of a guy, you would never know me because I'm just not that. In fact, I've often said that when I speak, people tend to either go to sleep or have to go to the bathroom. Somehow, I seem to have a calming effect on people without even trying to. I am not a drill sergeant. I've even tried to be before, and it just didn't work. So you would never be able to have fellowship with me on a very intimate level if you believed that about me, because that's not who I am. Well, similarly, when we miss the magnitude of the humility of God, either in our thoughts or in practice, we cannot know God. This is why a proud person doesn't seem to make much progress towards knowing God. They're not moving that direction. They're moving away from Him if they don't think He's humble. As we said last week, the amazing thing about God being willing to be put into a baby's body is that even when He was placed there, He was still the very one in charge of all creation. Deity went into humanity. He still had made it all, and He was still presiding over it all. Our title this morning is "Because He Came, We Can Know Him." Jesus said, "Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart." That's from Matthew 11, 28 and 29. Just in passing this verse, let's notice two things. First, notice that the issue of learning from Jesus, of knowing him in experience, is associated with some sort of work. He says, take my yoke upon you. A yoke is for working. That's important. It gives the indication that he's talking about active learning. Second, notice that the reason we can know him is because he is gentle and humble. This word humble, it means not rising far off the ground. You know, it's lowly. You can learn from Jesus. He's not pretentious. He's not haughty, lifted up. He'll work with you and walk with you and talk with you on your level. A verse in Hebrews says something important about this. It's in Hebrews, the very first three verses in Hebrews. Hebrews 1, verses 1 through 3, says this. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers, now this is written to the Hebrews, so this would be speaking of the Hebrew fathers, Abraham and the guys that came after him. He spoke to them in to the fathers in the prophets, in many portions and in many ways. In these last days, and we're certainly in the last days, if the early Christians were in the last days, he has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. Just like we said last week from Colossians, that he made the world through him. But verse 3 is what we want to focus on. And he, Jesus, the Son of God, is the radiance of his glory. It means that he perfectly reflects the Father's glory. He would be like a mirror, although he's the real thing, but he would be like a mirror without any blemish on it. And the exact representation of his nature. Now, Jesus wasn't having to just represent his nature. He was God, and so he displayed the nature, but this is how you would say that he perfectly, exactly represents the nature of God the Father. So God went one step farther beyond written revelation in revealing what he is like. He actually came and dwelt among us. He has wanted us to know him. Well, what was the result when the Son of God came? Was his divinity convincing? Well, yes, it was to some, especially to the lowly, but not to everyone. John's gospel says that he came to his own, and his own did not receive him. Why? Because some supposed that the God of the universe, the Messiah, would come in power and great glory, and he will. It's coming. He's coming. But they did not expect him to come in obscurity. Why? Because they could not imagine that the God of the universe was powerful and at the same time humble. Let me give you a working definition of this word humble. It means a proven willingness to play whatever role God asks you to play. Humility is a proven willingness to play whatever role God asks you to play. The King of the universe took up residence in a baby's body. He grew no faster than any other baby. He experienced multiple moves with his earthly family, born in Bethlehem. I mean, his first trip was in the womb, first long trip. Then they had to rush off to Egypt. Then they came out of Egypt a couple years later and got scared again and ended up in Nazareth. So he moved several times with his family. He probably buried his earthly dad sometime when he himself was between 12 and 30 years of age. But for the most part, he was unknown for 30 years. This is God being unknown for 30 years. That was at least one demonstration of his humility. What's important here to understand is that the Son of God did not change his character to be put into a human baby's body. This was in keeping with his eternal nature. Remember that Hebrews says that he perfectly reflected the Father's glory in coming to earth. Well, that means that part of the glory of God the Father is that he is humble, always has been, always will be. And going on another step farther, those of us who have believed on Jesus Christ, we have the third person of the Trinity, the Holy Spirit, living in our bodies right now. God is humble and always has been and always will be. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. I very much appreciate what Del Tackett has been saying in our Truth Project sessions, that God does not ask of us anything other than what we should be like He is. Doesn't ask us to be anything except to be like He is. That is, the Ten Commandments are a reflection of His own character, not an arbitrary obstacle course to see if we can get through it. So God says, do not kill, because He would never kill the innocent. He says, do not steal, because His nature is to be a giver and not a taker. He says, do not bear false witness, because God knows and only speaks what is true. And so it is, if you look at Philippians 2, that the Holy Spirit inspired Paul to write to the believers, again, asking us to be nothing other than what He is like. He says, have this attitude in yourselves. Oh, by the way, I didn't write the reference down. It'd be about verses 5 through 8 here, I believe. Philippians 2, I believe we're in about 5 through 8. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although He existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped. Isn't that amazing? He had all the prestige, all the honor. We have presidents, you know, who leave office and it's kind of hard to shed. They all have to at least write their memoirs. You know, it's just not something that is easily dropped. But it was for Jesus. He did not regard it a thing to be clutched or grasped, but He emptied Himself, taking the form of a bond servant and being made in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, He humbled Himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Do you see why God asks you to be humble? It's so that you can know Him. Knowing someone is enjoying something in common. Relationships are built this way. I want to give you a demonstration. I'm going to tell you a joke, and you laugh when we get to the punchline, and we'll share this together. Don't worry, this is not a groaner. This is not one of Bob's puns. This is a legitimate joke. Okay? There are two guys that apply for the same job, and an interviewer interviews each of them. And after that, he can't make a decision about which one to hire. So he calls them both in, and he gives them each the same 20-question test. And he puts them in a room and tells them to come back when they have finished the test. They bring their tests back, and he asks them, why don't they just wait, you know, in the employee lounge while he quickly looks over the answers on their exams. So they do that, and he looks over their tests, and he calls them back in and says, well, I've made my decision, and I've decided to hire this guy. Well, the guy who did not get hired says, well, wait a minute, I thought I did pretty well on that exam. I mean, how'd you make your decision? And the interviewer says, well, I actually, you're right, you both got 19 out of 20 correct. See? I got 19 out of 20. How could you possibly hire him instead of me? And the interviewer says, well, I didn't hire you for the questions that you got right. I decided against you because of the one question that you both got wrong. On question number 7, he put down, I don't know. And you put down, neither do I. Okay, so I didn't laugh because I've heard it so many times. But if we were together, if you'd have laughed at it, it would have been easier for me to laugh. But for those of you who laughed with me, we've just built our relationship in one small way because we enjoyed something together. We had a laugh together. And it's like that with knowing Jesus. We can't say that we truly know Him until we have experienced His activity in our lives and His activity will be marked with a requirement that we humbly trust Him many times. Now, the trouble with this message is that we have to apply it. The world we live in, John says, lies in the power of the evil one. For a time, God has just allowed that. Since the time of Satan's downfall, he has been an antagonist to humility. Remember how he pumped himself up? He didn't want to put himself below God the Father any longer. He has promoted self-actualization here on this earth, personal strength, you know, going after prestige and honors and success on this earth from the praise of man. That has become the music that this world is playing, and it can be hard not to listen to it. This is why a natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit. He's hearing the world's music, which is influenced greatly by prideful Satan. And it makes it seem like there are no other sensible options. Think about this. Who in this world would suggest to you, why not rather be wronged than to go to court against a fellow believer? No! In this world, what makes sense is that you assert yourself, that you present yourself from being walked on. But Paul's reasoning with the Corinthians shows a spiritual wisdom that goes beyond earthly reasoning. Who in this world would tell you, be submissive to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable? For this finds favor if, for the sake of conscience towards God, a man bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly. What? Who would do that? Who would say that? But you know what? That very passage, that was from 1 Peter 2, chapter 2, starting in 18. I think it's part of 19 as well. That little passage there was tremendous milestone in my life. I was in a position where I needed to practice that. And because I repeated it to myself hundreds of times, I felt like I could believe it. I felt like I was doing the will of God. I was suffering. And I felt like I might actually obtain the favor of God if I simply bore up under my troubles. And tremendous wellspring for me. Do you see how there must be a connection between humility, a willingness to play this kind of role, and the spiritual wisdom and understanding which would motivate it? You got to be humble, but you got to know what God's will is and see it with your hard eyes. This is just huge to understand. The largest reason that sometimes we avoid being treated unjustly or avoid taking the lowly tasks or associating with the lowly is that we don't think it should be required of us. So we check out. The other night, I was busy working on a project in my radon stuff, and I wanted to get a big deal done. And I got a call from Darcy. Darcy was doing some babysitting, and she needed an errand to be run because she couldn't break away from what she was doing. And I said I'd try to take care of it, and I tried to delegate it, and I thought I had it done, but I got another call from Darcy. Said, no, I still need one thing. So I thought, okay, I'll just run over, take care of the errand, and get right back to work, which I did. I got back to my desk, and the phone rang again, and it was Darcy again. He said, hey, Bob, I was wondering, can you just run over and pick up Rex and Nina from the game store? You know, otherwise they'll have to walk home. And I sort of stammered a little bit, but I said, yeah, okay, yeah. It wouldn't take that long. I just run over there, grab them, take them home, get back to work. When I opened the door to the game store, there were about 10 people in there. And I thought, I bet Rex and Nina can't leave right now. And as I was standing there pondering that, Brad came up and he said, oh, hey, Bob, did you drive here? Can you give me a ride home? And I thought, what, Brad? I was thinking this. I don't even know where he lives. I mean, I don't want to drive around all night. While I was thinking of those things, Dominic came over and he said, hey, Bob, could you give me a ride? I need a ride home. And I don't know if my jaw was dropping or where I was at that point, but before I could respond to these guys affirmatively, Nina said, "Bob, I was wondering, can you give Natalie a ride home?" I thought, "Well, wait a minute, Natalie lives in the country. I was about ready to turn around and find out if there's a candid camera someplace. I mean, this is getting funnier by the minute." "Oh, and we've been there before, haven't we? That is how it goes." And it went on, and basically it took me 3 hours from the time of the first phone call to the time I got back to my work again. But I moved on, and by, I think it was 2:38 the next morning, I was done with my project, and I was filled with joy. I had done the will of God, and He blessed me. Actually, it was an application for my radon testing, and just this week I learned that I am going to be certified, so that night was a total success for me. Sometimes the greatest hindrance to experiencing God in our lives is a lack of humility. It is a lack of being willing to play whatever role, do whatever task, or serve in whatever capacity might meet a need that God shows us. This morning, Tim was on the alert again, and since we couldn't do church, he suggested going to shovel people out. I mean, that's why we can't meet for church, and our four-wheel drive vehicles were working, so he suggested that we scoop people out. Tremendous idea, but a humble one as well. What would have happened in Mary's relationship with God had she refused the embarrassment of pregnancy outside of wedlock? I mean, would she have known God the same way? Absolutely not. Every single man or woman of God who knows God intimately is humble. And every single one of them had to learn to be so. Which is my last point this morning. Because He came, we can know Him. But we won't know Him if we don't engage in spiritual wisdom and understanding. We need to sit at the feet of Jesus, as the woman did in the Gospels, until we see the connection between what God is commanding us to do and why He would command us to do such a thing. Without this connection, all the commands of God are burdensome, and they just seem unnecessary, or maybe even, you know, cultishly unrealistic. But when God opens our heart eyes to see that He's just giving us an opportunity to laugh with Him, to have a party like Stephen did, as Tim pointed out, then His commands seem like an invitation to a great adventure. Saints, all the treasures of life are hidden in Jesus Christ, and each one of them has your name on it. It's made personal, only to be unwrapped by some experience of willing obedience, in which if He doesn't come through, you're going to look like a fool. But He is faithful, and when He comes through for you, it doesn't matter who thinks what, you will have the private inner knowledge that you did what He wanted you to do and participated in the glory of His kingdom. And you will know Him as He really is. I struggled this morning with how to present this message in a practical way so that it would not just be a theory or information. It just seemed like the message could be 100 hours long if I were to touch on numerous practical examples. So I finally thought of this. I thought I would perhaps give to you a list of some of the commands of the New Testament. That way, you could look at the list and ask yourself, what do I think of this command? Does it make sense that God would ask me to do this? Why do I think He would want this? And lastly, am I willing to play the role with the humility of Jesus? This list, and by the way, this list that I'm talking about is another Word document that my helpers are going to get on this website of ours. It should be called... See, because He came, we can know Him, and then I think it says knowing Him in the humility of obedience or something like that. And And it's just 100 or just a few more than 100. I could have done a lot more of them, but about 100 of them. And I want you, these four questions that I just gave you are on that page. And you go through that list, asking those questions. These will get you started. Because he came, we can know him and have fellowship with him. Again, you know what? If you want to get more, if you want to know more about the mental process involved in spiritual growth, I'd encourage you, I've mentioned this before, but I'd encourage you to listen to my podcast entitled Knowing You, Jesus. That's on our website also. Not just because I did it, I just liked the way that fell together, putting the parts of it in line, and it might be helpful to you. By no means have I arrived, but this process doesn't have to be total mystery. So we can know him, but we can only know him through spiritual wisdom and understanding. Spiritual wisdom offers to us the motivation to walk as he walks and enjoy what he enjoys, making the movie of our life rich with the drama of the eternal. God grant us mercy and grace to do this together here at Lifehouse. I love you all.